Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. I am honored to have presidential candidate Marianne Williamson here with us in the house, as we like to say, having a conversation. And we were before we went to break, we were talking about the infrastructure and sort of the politics. Now I want to move us a little bit into the policy side of the equation, because we don't, as a country, have those conversations anymore. And I think you were making a very important point before we went to break about why that's important inside of a primary process among competing interests and competing candidates for the nomination, which the structures don't necessarily want to have happen. You've laid out in your campaign the what you call an economic bill of rights. And I'm going to tick off a couple so folks get a sense of where you are focusing. You talk about the right to a job that pays a living wage, the right to a voice in the workplace through a union and collective bargaining, the right to universal quality health care, the right to a cost-free higher education, the right to good, affordable housing, the right to a clean environment and healthy planet, the right to a meaningful endowment of resources at birth, the right to sound banking and financial services, the right to an equitable and fair justice system, the right to cultural and civic involvement in democratic life. All of that, broadly speaking, is sound, solid. I think every American would go, yeah, that makes sense. Of course, you and I know the devil is always in the details. How do we do that? How do we reconcile that the idea of creating a right that pays a living wage when you have this sort of capitalist mindset versus all the other pieces that go into making that system work the way it does, where you have those who control the capital versus those who want access to it. Talk to us about how you see doing this as president with a Republican House that stands largely in opposition to everything I just mentioned. This iteration, because my kind of Republicanism, we can find work together space here, a number of these things, right? I am not an anti-union Republican, for example, so I get it. I am, certainly I did my battle in universal health care, for example, and lost that battle. So the question now is, how do we make it work for everybody? So let's talk about that. So how, given the Republican opposition that you would have as president of the United States come January of 25,
well, first of all, we don't
begin to build that bipartisan ladder.
First of all, you don't know that. If I'm a president inaugurated in 2025, for all you know, it's going to be a Democratic House and a Democratic
Senate. I'm glad you said that. Okay, let's put a pin there, because I would submit to you, Madam President, you would have problems inside your own caucus with some of this.
That's actually true.
Okay.
Actually, I would agree with that. No, I'm not naive about that. But hold on a second. Listen, we don't want the president to have a magic wand. I wouldn't have one, and no American president should have a magic wand. We have three co-equal branches of government. But the president still has the power that the president has. The president has the power of the appointments over these agencies, many of which have been captured by corporate forces. The president has the power, when necessary and if need be and if appropriate, of the executive orders. And also the president has the bully pulpit. And I think that that would be one of the greatest benefits of my presidency. I would lay it down as honestly with people as president as I lay it down honestly as a candidate. So that's number one. The president said, Franklin Roosevelt said the primary responsibility importance of the presidency is not administrative, but moral leadership. We need a vision for this country, which, interestingly enough, to me, is a return to the Declaration of Independence. Abraham Lincoln said the Declaration of Independence is an eternal rebuke to forces of tyranny and oppression. It's like America's mission statement. John Adams said he hoped we would revisit it every July 4th. We need to revisit what our North Star is. And I would be very vocal about that. And I think that would be a large part. I would be laying down and reclaiming the American vision. Would I win every single battle? No. But I would be leaning against the wall. And I think I would be helping to create the space, whether I as president was able to effectuate those changes or not, of making them foundational in the consciousness of enough Americans that it would be inevitable that those things would occur.
So let's take the Marianne Williamson Bill of Rights number 4, the right to a cost-free higher education. Is that the proper place for government to act? Since our educational system is both private and public, we have public schools, we have private schools. The idea that the government somehow now is going to force these institutions to do what? Because the problem is, I mean, in other words, I've sat on university boards. And I can tell you those decisions are made absent any government involvement. And so the idea of raising the cost of tuition seems to be something that we either incentivize or disincentivize these institutions to do. Parents still write the check. It does marginalize those students who otherwise would go but now can't. Where does the government play a role in that part of getting education into the hands of kids, particularly now that you're seeing it in judicial matters? The courts are like, oh, sorry, Biden administration, you that's a bridge too far.
Well, isn't it interesting? Nobody asks that question if you're talking about an eighth grader or a ninth grader. If they're an eighth or ninth grader, it's understood that in order to have an educated citizenry, as Thomas Jefferson said, people must be educated. That he said the only safe repository for power is in the hands of the people. And the reason he stood for public education was so that the people had educated critical thought processes, because we must, if we are to oversee the governance of a great nation. And right now we're farming out our critical thought. Now, before the 1970s, Michael, we had it. We had it at University of Florida. We had it at University of Texas. We had it at University of California. We had it. This was not a question of the proper role of government. This is a question of the tentacles extended not by capitalism. I'm not an anti-capitalist. This is a malevolent form. Remember, Adam Smith himself, the primary architect of free market capitalism, said it cannot exist outside an ethical context. This is a malevolent form of vulture capitalism, crony capitalism. This is why you have 1.3 million people rationing their insulin in this country. You don't have that in any other advanced democracy. It's only because of the greed of the pharmaceuticals. People with a 1 in 4 medical debt, only because of the greed of the insurance company. So the way this malevolent form, and I know this might sound extreme, but I want you to really take in what I'm saying. This malevolent strain of capitalism, I do not believe it is inherent in capitalism. And I say that because some people actually do. I don't. Mm-hmm. I think there is righteous profit and so forth. I understand the high side of the free market, as I know you do. Mm-hmm. Okay. As we talked about before, my problem is not enough people can get into that. We're talking about a strain which is soulless. A strain which puts short-term profit for its own stockholders before any other stakeholders. And what do they prey on first? Human desperation. Because if human beings are desperate for something, look what they'll do. So to prey on the desperation of our young people who only want to self-actualize, who want to get in the game, who want to be young capitalists, who want to be young entrepreneurs, and you're sitting on top of them because of banks and financial institutions and educational institutions went, ooh, there's a buck to be had there. It is immoral. And absolutely, if the government, if as the Declaration of Independence said, the governments are instituted to secure the inalienable right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To me, a higher education is simply a part by which people pursue happiness. And these young people and they're so depressed, Michael. There are so many people, they come out of school, they took out these huge loans, and I have to tell you, debt is crippling. But I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in my 20s and carry tens of thousands of dollars of debt. So they come out of school, they got the degree, in the field they want to be in. And they look at the sheet and they look at what they owe. And they can't imagine going in, starting at the bottom in the field.
Yeah,
that
because
they
the
just
market's
the
not paying
in.
That. Right.
So they end up working a job they hate and wondering why they even went to college. And then you have the consequence of that is how many people are saying, now why even go to college? Like, we need more dumbing down.
Well, how do you break that cycle? I mean, what? Again,
you
the
go
question
back to
is,
what we had. We had it at University of Florida. We had it at University of Texas.
So, but what does the government do to get Harvard University to cut its tuition?
Not Harvard. We're not talking about private universities. You know that. We're not talking about Harvard. We're not talking about Harvard right now, for sure. We're talking about public colleges and universities. We're not talking about Harvard. We're not talking about Dartmouth. We're not talking about Stanford.
But that's as much of, I mean, yeah, you have the choice to go to a private school versus a public school. And you're right. Public education at the university level is just as high in some cases. You know, certainly $45,000, $50,000 a year to go to a public university. But what is the underlying reason for that? I would. Are you saying that that insidious sort of greed has affected the governmental institutions of higher education, public education?
I'm saying it's infected every corner of our society, including the U.S. government. That it has
The U.S. government doesn't run Maryland University. The state of Maryland runs Maryland University. So what is it at the state level that is not taking into account what you just described, such that students who want to get quality education at a state-run university can do so, and they're not having to decide between, university, private university X and state university Y. I mean, it's obvious. I'm going to go to the state university because the quality of education is just as good as Harvard, but at half the cost. That's not the reality.
When Ronald Reagan was governor in California, he was the one who dismantled the system by which, you know, the crown jewel of California at that time was, you know, University of California, Berkeley, University of California, Santa Cruz, that was eminently affordable. So that was a state issue. It wasn't a federal issue.
Right. So, but you're talking about the right to cost-free higher education. Who's paying for that? The federal government's going to pay for that, or the state's going to pay for that, since the states are the ones that own and run the schools.
When people are more educated, when people have a college education, they have on average, I don't know what the specific average, but they make more money. And as we make more money, you have a higher tax basis. Let's talk about what they do in Australia.
Yeah, but I got to get to the school.
No, hold on.
First.
I want to answer your question. Please let me answer the question.
Let's take the high school student.
How are we going to pay for it? I'm trying to hold on. Let me say something. When it comes to both health and education, there are many systems throughout Europe, throughout Australia, New Zealand, et cetera. We take the best. Let's talk about what they do in Australia. In Australia, for instance, someone can go as high as their achievement level will take them. Okay? You get your BA, you get the equivalent of your MA, you could even get your PhD. You go as high as your achievement level will take you. The government then registers, and we know from people's taxes how much money you're making. When you get to the point, this is what they do in Australia, and I think that's what we should do here. When you get to the point that you're beginning to pay back those loans would not in any way diminish your ability to live a minimum standard of a dignified life, the government starts paying itself back. That's what they do in Australia, and that's what we should do here.
Marianne,
I shouldn't put you on that particular committee, huh, Michael?
No.
I shouldn't put you in charge of that particular committee. What do you have a problem? Why do you have a problem with what? With that?
I don't have a problem. I'm just trying to navigate through the reality here, and that is, our system, our educational system, is not set up the same way as Australia. The incentives are different. Number one. There is much more of a federal interest in education than there is here. All right.
There should be. Look what it has done to this country.
But let me finish the point. You have people in this country, and it's not just Republicans who want to dismantle the Department of Education. So the incentives are different, number one. Number two, every state, the 50 states and the territories run their educational system, not the federal government. The state of Maryland, the state of California, the state of Florida run their systems. They have state schools. They have community colleges. They run their system. So I hear what you're saying about people getting to the point where they're going to pay back the loans. My point is, why is the number so high to begin with? Your right to education, a cost-free higher education. You say a cost-free higher education. That means the states will then take on that burden. And okay. So that means the $48,000 that it costs to go to University of Maryland or the $50,000 it costs to go to the University of Florida, the state's going to absorb that and students are going to go cost-free. How do taxpayers carry that, number one?
Okay.
And number two, what are the other incentives besides basically shifting the burden?
What do you mean the other incentives besides shifting the burden? I'm not sure.
You're going to shift the burden of taxpayers right now already pay for that public education.
That's
right.
We're
paying for it.
All right. Let me tell you what else we're paying for. We're paying for the dumbing down of Americans. We're paying for the fact that only 11 states require American history, American civics, and American government. Hold on a moment. We are paying a terrible cost for the dumbing down of Americans, but I want to go back to FDR and the GI Bill. Everybody understands that the GI Bill, allowing the veterans who came back from World War II to get an education, that built America's middle class. Now, what Franklin Roosevelt wanted was tuition-free college for every American. The Southern racist senators didn't want that because they didn't want to educate Black people. But given what the GI Bill did to build the American middle class, can you imagine what it would do for our economy if everyone had been afforded that right? We should be thinking more than just immediate. We should be thinking about investing in our future. America needs a more educated population. Right now, you have to be among the privileged to have access to healthcare, to have easy access to education.
But you got Obamacare. You don't need to be privileged to have Obamacare.
Hold on a second. 85 million of the neoliberal, the corporatist Democrats won. Hold on a moment. 85 million Americans are underinsured or uninsured.
Point of Obamacare?
But that's the whole point. You still have one in four Americans living with medical debt. That's why we need Medicare for all. That's why we need universal health care. You have 18 million Americans who cannot afford to pay for the prescriptions their doctors give them. What happens, and I've had doctor after doctor tell me this. I've had doctors say, I don't even know why I'm practicing anymore. Because the insurance will cover for you to go to the doctor, but the insurance won't cover the tests that the doctor prescribes. It won't cover the medicine. It won't cover the operation. Yeah, it won't. What Obamacare was the insurance company saying to Obama, this is as far as we'll let you go.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise, and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.